Hello and welcome to the latest episode of The Airline Pilot Guy. I'm Captain Jeff, your airline pilot guy. Welcome to the podcast. Now, this is going to be a little bit different than previous podcasts, what you're normally used to. And that's because this is yet another commemoration or reflection on that fateful day 10 years ago, 9/11/2001. Now, I know it's a couple days now past that date, that anniversary. It's the 13th of September. I'm recording this. And I know many of you probably are a little fatigued by all the commemorations and memorials and such. But I thought it was still important for me to talk about this because it was something that was quite tragic for all of us in the world, actually, but especially those of us in the United States and those of us who work in the airline industry. Jeff Felmuth, American Airlines first officer, sent me an email a couple weeks ago talking about the fact that he had written this narrative that he sends out to his friends and family every year. And he had recalled that I had read this over the air a couple of years ago. And he asked that I might consider doing that again. And, you know, it got me to thinking, not only would I love to do that again, but I'd also like to hear some other stories from you out there. So many of you responded, and I appreciate that. And I've selected a few to talk about on this week's podcast. So we'll start with Jeff Felmuth's story, and it goes like this. Most of you know that I'm a pilot for American Airlines, and on 9/11/01, I was flying a Boeing 767, the same type that hit the Twin Towers, from Caracas, Venezuela, to New York. We had left Caracas at 8 a.m., so we had no idea what was going on until we reached the radar-controlled airspace surrounding Puerto Rico. The air traffic controller would only tell that JFK was closed, and we needed to contact our company. When we queried the controller about why the airport was closed, he responded, "I can't tell you over an open frequency." The captain and I are both retired Air Force pilots, and those words sent a huge chill through both of us. So when we used the satellite phone in the cockpit to contact American Airlines in Dallas, the dispatcher in Dallas only told us that two airplanes had flown into the World Trade Center towers and that we should divert to Miami. He did not tell us the planes were airliners or that one of the planes was an American Airlines flight. We immediately knew it was some kind of an attack, but never dreamed it was airliners. Rather, we were thinking light aircraft out of one of the numerous northern New Jersey airports. The only other communication we received from the company was a message telling us that not even the flight attendants were to be allowed in the cockpit. Well, after that message, the crash axe was in my lap for the remainder of the flight. We elected not to tell anybody on board we were diverting to Miami, not even the flight attendants. As far as anyone on board knew, we were on our way to New York. About halfway between Puerto Rico and Miami, Miami Air Traffic Control transmitted the following: "All U.S. airspace is closed. I will call you back shortly to find out where you want to land outside of the United States." He then began contacting individual flights and sending them to numerous airports all over the Caribbean, Central, and South America. After about 15 to 20 minutes of him diverting planes, the controller announced that three flights would be allowed to land in Miami. We were first, followed by a continental flight 30 minutes behind, and then an American flight 1 hour behind. To my knowledge, these were the last three flights to land at Miami that day and were probably some of the last flights to enter U.S. airspace. Miami International is an extremely busy airport, and the skies around Miami are normally full of aircraft and the accompanying radio chatter, but not when we arrived. When we checked in with Miami Approach Control, there was an eerie silence as we were the only aircraft in their airspace. The tension in the cockpit was pretty thick at this point, since even at 3 in the morning, you usually aren't alone with Miami Approach. Our approach was pretty uneventful until about 4 miles out from landing, when our flaps malfunctioned. We didn't dare go around at this point to run our checklist. We simply took what we had for flaps and landed on the north runway at Miami. Now came the real shock. The north side of the Miami airport is a huge parking area used mainly by cargo and charter aircraft. Well, on 9/11, the north ramp was covered with more airplanes than I'd ever seen. They were packed in like sardines, and for any of you who have been to the military and civilian aircraft storage facilities in Arizona, well, this was even tighter. Up again went the pucker factor. Our flap malfunction prevented us from retracting our flaps after landing, which, before 9/11, was a huge problem for us. To taxi into the parking area with your flaps down was a signal to ground personnel that you were being hijacked and wanted arm intervention right now. I'm thinking this as I look to my left and see all these jets crammed together. So as we clear the runway, the first word out of my mouth are, "Ground, American 936 is clear of runway 09 left, and our flaps are down because they're broken." Yes, I was yelling. Somehow, we were given a gate to park at, and then as we pulled up, the captain made a PA to the passengers, telling them the little that we knew. "Ladies and gentlemen, some of you may have realized by looking outside or at your watches that this is not New York." He then told the passengers to remain seated until we had all had a chance to talk to the agents meeting the flight. Now, you must remember, we still don't know that commercial airlines have been used in this attack, nor do we know about the Pentagon, a flight 93 in Pennsylvania. The agent came on board and made a PA informing the passengers and the crew of the events, and now, for the first time, we know of the devastation in New York, as by this time both towers were down. You could have heard a pin drop. On the home front, my wife and children, at this time 14, 9, and 6, have no idea where I am, only that I'm supposed to be home that afternoon. When I turn on my cell phone, there's a tear-filled voicemail from my wife, wondering where I am, or even if I am. But because of the phone system where she worked, I can't reach her. I do contact the grade school for my two younger kids, and when I tell the secretary that I'm a pilot for American Airlines, she just lost it. My kids expected me home that day, and I asked her to contact them at the end of the school day. They hadn't told the kids about the attacks, that I was okay and in Miami. She also contacted the high school for me, where a guidance counselor went to my oldest daughter's class. Needless to say, having guidance come to your room looking for you while you're watching aircraft like your dad's crash is pretty intense for a 16-year-old. I think she had it worse than I did, since I knew I was okay. I finally did get a hold of Debbie, my parents and in-laws, but I couldn't tell them much except that I was in Miami for a while, and I didn't even know where I was going to be staying. It took a couple of hours, but we ended up at our normal layover hotel in Miami Beach, where I spent the next 5 days watching the F-15s fly up and down the beach, wishing I was back with them. I'd only been retired for a year. I finally got home Saturday night, around midnight, and spent Sunday close to my family. Monday morning found me on my way back to JFK for my next flight. My normal 2 to 2.5 hour drive took 4 hours that Monday, and crossing over the Verrazano Narrows Bridge was truly humbling. The Twin Towers were the dominant feature of Manhattan, especially the lower end, and the Verrazano offers a beautiful view of New York Harbor and lower Manhattan. 6 days later, the fire was still burning. Smoke was still rising from Ground Zero. Plus, there was a huge gap in the buildings where the towers had been. 8 years later, I still look and miss the sight of the World Trade Center. Will I ever forget? Never. Every time I go to work, I think about what happened that day and wonder when they'll try it again, and I'll be ready. I will always remember that day, where I was, what I and my family went through, and I will always remember others. I will always remind others of what happened that day and what it means to me, my freedom, and my way of life. Jeff Felmuth, American Airlines pilot. Thank you, Jeff. In his P.S., he writes, "I send this letter out every year, now as we approach the anniversary of that fateful day. May we never forget those who died that day, nor the freedoms and liberty we enjoy in this great country." Hear, hear. Thank you, Jeff. And here's one from my friend, an air traffic controller out in Southern California, Kevin Cox. Dear Captain Jeff, I was planning on giving you feedback of what happened to me on 9/11, but after reading this story on the FAA employee's website, I thought it would be a better one during our time of remembrance. I've included the link below and the whole story. Take care and God bless. Kevin Cox. And here's the story. Nearly 800 miles separated Nashville FAAers Sherry Jensen and Mark Heron and a six-month-old girl awaiting a life-saving organ transplant in Texas on September 11th, 2001. But the lives of these three individuals soon unforgettably intersected on that day of the deadliest terror attacks on U.S. soil. That sunny September morning had started as any other day in the Nashville Tower. That quickly changed, said Jensen, the tower's air traffic manager. One of the controllers came in and said, "Sherry, a plane just hit the World Trade Center." Jensen and her colleagues gathered in front of the television in the break room and watched the massive tragedy unfold. "We just looked at each other in silence," she said. A ringing phone soon broke the silence, and the call carried emergency instructions for the tower's personnel to enter the control room and to land all aircraft. Controllers set to work re-clearing planes for landing in Nashville and other airports as part of a national grounding. No one knew exactly what was wrong, except that we were protecting the flying public and to get the planes out of the air, Jensen said. We were just doing our job. There was quiet, and that was the most unusual part. Eventually, another call came into tower. This time, carrying a plea for help from Tennessee Donor Services, a Tennessee-based organization that arranges organ donations for an infant girl in Houston named Karina, whose liver function had failed. The baby's life depended on the transport of an 11-ounce liver being recovered at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville. The plane had been scheduled to fly the liver to Karina, had been grounded along with all civilian aircraft across the country. The organization's executive director, Jill Maxfield Grandis, had placed the call from her office after locating the tower's number in a phone book. Jensen took the call. She answered the phone, and I told her the circumstances and that we were in the hospital operating room, Grandis said. She said, "I understand your emergency. Let me make some calls." Within a very short period of time, we were back on the phone together. Jensen turned to operations manager Mark Heron for assistance. He and one of the tower's supervisors started making calls to secure an aircraft to transport the organ to Karina. "She was able to make it real for us," Jensen said. "It had become a life for us and someone we could do something for." She recalled a statement that Heron made as he quickly started making calls. Quote, "They're not taking one more life today." Heron called his personal contacts at home and on their cell phones and was told that only military flights were allowed to enter the airspace. He remembered the daughter of an Air National Guard colonel he had recently met when she came by the tower for a tour, and he had kept her business card in his desk. He called the woman's cell number and asked her to put him in touch with her father. When the colonel called, Heron connected him with Grandis, and, among a flurry of calls, a 38-ton C-130 military transport was prepared for takeoff from the Tennessee National Guard base, transporting the liver in a tiny cooler to Texas. "I just put the right people together," Heron said. "I was thinking about some poor child down there in Texas who could possibly die. It was a matter of life and death." Grandis expressed her appreciation for the agency's quick response and perseverance. They took 9 crewmen from the Tennessee National Guard and this little baby liver in a little cooler and left for Houston. It was really just so gratifying what we could accomplish and have so many folks not just say no. We didn't expect that they would be able to jump through so many hoops of getting a yes to let a plane take off. The transplant was successful, and the parents of that little girl eventually sent Heron a photo of her that she still keeps in his office in the tower. He praised the team effort of controllers, pilots, and other personnel that day. 10 years later, he holds memories of the attacks and lives lost. "Like many people in this country, I certainly think about it," he says. "I hope it never happens again. I think my guard goes up on that day. It does seem like it was just yesterday that it happened." When she left the tower that night, Sherry Jensen was struck by the silence brought by the lack of aircraft in the sky. On her mind were the day's events that cost lives in New York, Washington, D.C., and in rural Pennsylvania. She expressed pride and how our team of controllers banded together to maintain safety in the midst of chaos. "They're a very committed group," Jensen said. "They had a renewed sense of purpose, that what we do is important and does make a difference in people's lives." "There was also an important lesson about humanity that day," she said. "The bright spot that can happen is the belief in human nature. Something terrible can happen, but there are still good human beings that will take action to make a difference." Thanks for forwarding that article, Kevin. And this from Michael Kramer. "Captain Jeff, I'm happy that you'll be doing a show on September 11th. I flew the weekend before, and for some reason, when coming home on Sunday, was thinking about how someone could still hijack a plane. I had to go to Washington, D.C. a couple weeks after September 11th while flights were still grounded at Reagan National. I heard about the effects on the people who worked at the airport, especially the waiters at the restaurants. I made a point to go to the airport and eat at one of the restaurants to help out these people that I did not think about being affected. About 3 weeks after September 11th, I flew from Orlando on United Airlines. Before we took off, the pilot announced that several of the people who were killed on the flights on September 11th were friends of his. He also said that if anyone on the flight acted aggressively or as if they were going to try to hijack the plane, to please help the flight attendants, even if throwing whatever we could reach at these people. Everyone clapped, and I know that I felt better about flying. A few months later, I read that a pilot who made the same announcement, I assume it was this pilot, was disciplined for making this statement to passengers. I've always felt that this was a great injustice. Keep up the good work. I wrote instead of phoning because your voice is much more pleasant than mine." Well, thanks, Mike. I'm sure you have a nice voice too. And thank you for that feedback. And finally, this is from Lisa. "I was working at the hospital in North New Jersey on September 11th, 2001. I remember thinking, what a beautiful day this is, on my ride into work. The next thing I knew, the laboratory secretary told me a plane crashed into the World Trade Center. My first thought was that, that's impossible. The visibility is amazing today. I went up to look at the TV in the radiology department, and sure enough, she was right. I assumed it was a small airplane at first. As a private pilot that trained in New Jersey, I flew up the Hudson River many times at about 1,000 feet, which is lower than the Twin Towers. I could not conceive of a plane accidentally hitting the tower. Shortly after that, the news of a second plane crash became known. Our hospital began our emergency procedures. As a department manager, I did my part to help in the preparations of the expected influx of casualties. Rumors started flying. Worried employees tried to reach their loved ones. One close associate of mine had a brother-in-law that had just graduated college and began working at Cantor Fitzgerald. Another had a sister bound for work at the World Trade Center. Fortunately, the sister went in late and missed the tragedy. The young brother-in-law was not as fortunate. I went up to the top floor of the hospital and looked at the skyline in disbelief at the one remaining tower. Finally, it dawned on me, call my sister to check on Mike. I called the hospital that she worked at in Staten Island. They told me she went home. I called her house. She said to call the computer phone number as she was leaving the house phone open for her husband Mike's call. She did not sound well. Mike was a New York City FDNY lieutenant. I tried calling his cell phone. No answer. I left messages to please call us. As the hours went by, I tried to get information on the internet, but the service was sporadic. It was very difficult to find out what was really happening down there. I told my secretary to beep me if my sister called. All day, I hung on to the hope that he was there and very busy, too busy to call. I told my coworkers that he is down there, but I'm not too worried. I don't think anyone realized yet how grave the situation was for the fire department of New York. I emailed my close friends and relatives and asked them to pray for Mike. The influx of casualties never came. We directed many volunteers regarding blood donations. It was not needed. At 7 p.m., I left work and headed down the parkway towards my house. At the turnoff to the west, I could not bring myself to go home to my husband. himself a commercial pilot that was not on duty that day, and my baby. I headed to Staten Island, determined to get there using my hospital credentials. The roads were pretty empty, and the bridges were closed. Thankfully, my hospital credentials got me over the bridge into my sister's house. Her street was crowded with friends and family. The vigil had begun. The TV that showed the people jumping and the towers collapsing over and over again was not on in their house. It was too graphic for their 12 and 14-year-old children. Family drove up from Florida. They arrived Wednesday. My husband and little girl came on Thursday. The Catholic Church, three blocks from their home, began to hold a mass each evening at 7 p.m. to pray for the missing from the parish. It was very well attended. It hurt a lot to see his picture on the altar with the others. There were so many deliveries that came. Cards, food, flowers, gifts. So many people wanted to help, but it was also a little overwhelming. In late September, the news radio reported that the effort at Ground Zero was no longer a rescue. It was now called a recovery. Not long after that, we had a memorial mass for Mike, followed by a funeral when his body was recovered. A private pilot himself, Mike will most be remembered for the generous gifts of his time and talent as a carpenter, mover, coach, co-worker, and of course husband and father. Of the hundreds of people who attended his memorial service, nearly everyone had a story of how Mike helped them at some point. Yes, we've moved on, but we will never forget. My husband had an ICAO intersection name for him. It's near Bermuda. KWLTY for Mike Quilty, Ladder 11. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. Thank you, Lisa. And finally, before I sat down to record this special show, I came across an article, or actually a site. New York Times did a special collection of recordings, or selection of audio recordings from the FAA, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and American Airlines from the morning of September 11th. The recordings, some of which had been published previously, were released in a multimedia report on the New York Times website, originally intended to be part of the September 11 Commission's 2004 report. I'm including a link on the show notes for this show. I was thinking about playing some of these, but honestly, I listened to these on Saturday, and they're just under 40 minutes altogether, and it starts from just shortly after American Airlines Flight 11 had taken off out of Boston, and has some audio from one of the flight attendants using the airphone on board the airplane, talking to American Airlines headquarters, and her kind of explaining what was happening on the flight. And it also includes some pretty graphic and disturbing content, some recordings of the pilots of United Flight 93 that actually went out over the air. And let me tell you something. This really brought it back for me and had my heart beating and my adrenaline flowing. And so I invite you to go to the show notes and click on the link and just take some time to listen to this. It really brings it back and makes it real. So I thank you for listening today. I know it wasn't a normal show and it wasn't the most upbeat of things, but like so many things in our lives, tragedy usually makes room for goodness. And I think we saw a lot of that on after that fateful day. And we continue to see that in our great country. So until next time, let me end the show by praying a prayer that a lot of us pray, especially Catholics. We pray this for those who have lost their lives and have gone on to their next life. Eternal rest grant unto them, O Lord, and let perpetual light shine upon them. May May the souls of the faithful departed, through the mercy of God, rest in peace. Amen. Take care, and God bless.